I first of all want to thank the Young Israel of Avenue J for giving me this opportunity. The talks, and this is the first in four, as Herb has mentioned, will focus not just on American Jewish history, but particularly on those who remained or fought to remain observant and to encourage the growth of traditional Judaism, of Torah Judaism in America. Herb has mentioned the other lectures and the dates. I just want to add something. On the 27th of...
Fifth lecture.
On the 27th of February, that's Wednesday, after the talk, that's 2 weeks from tonight, there will be a special exhibit of rare and unusual materials related to American Jewish history, the Yosef Goldman collection. Yosef Goldman is a man who lives in this neighborhood, and he has probably the most extensive collection of various books and materials related to American Jewish history. I know, because every time I need something and I email him, he says, "I have it, come and get it." It's unbelievable, and you will see some very interesting things there. So that's 2 weeks from tonight. It'll be after the talk. Now, first of all, a disclaimer. I cannot cover everything of interest. Indeed, as I began to prepare the four lectures, I saw how much there is to talk about and how little I can really cover. That's number one. Number two, I may not cover your favorite topic. I apologize to you. This lecture is supposed to deal with the following, from Columbus to 1700. Columbus is 1492, as we know. We're going to talk about the Inquisition in Spain and Portugal. We're going to talk about Jews who came from with Columbus. We're going to talk about Jews in Central and South America, the Inquisition in its Mexico, because I happen to have a neighbor who was from that place, and he told me that it's a sound. So it's Mexico. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Recife, Brazil. We're going to talk about Jewish communities in the Caribbean, the first Jew in North America, Jews arrive in New Amsterdam, early New York Jewish communal life, Asa Levy, Jacob Bar Simpson, and Sherith Israel, if we get a chance. Now, when we talk about maintaining orthodoxy in America, the question is, how bad was it? What were they up against? Let me read you a quote. "I dwell in complete darkness without a teacher or companion. The religious life in this land is on the lowest level. Most people eat foul food and desecrate the Sabbath in public. Thousands marry non-Jewish women. Under these circumstances, my mind is perplexed, and I wonder whether it is even permissible for a Jew to live in this land. I am tired of my life. I often think of leaving and going to Paris and put my trust in the good Lord." Who wrote that? Rabbi Abraham Rice, 1802 to 1862. He was the first ordained Orthodox rabbi to come to America. He came in 1840, and it was a disaster. He went to Baltimore, and it was a total disaster. Another quote. "As recently as 1900, Rabbi Jacob David Wilowski, the rabbi of Slutsk, Lithuania, publicly proclaimed that anyone who emigrated to America was a sinner, since in America the oral law is trodden underfoot. It was not only home that the Jews left behind in Europe," he said, "it was their Torah, their Talmud, their yeshivas, in a word, their Yiddishkeit, their entire Jewish way of life." And it was indeed a disaster for an overwhelming number of Jewish people, sadly enough. But there were those who persevered against insurmountable odds, against unbelievable odds. Let's back up, though, before we talk about some specific people and paint the background of what really pushed Jews to come to America. And for that, we have to talk about the Inquisition. In the middle of the 12th century, fanatical Almohad Muslims overran southern Spain. They caused a massive exodus of the Jews to go to the Christian north. The golden age of Spain, in which the Jews lived with the Muslims, was over. And at first, the Christians welcomed the Jews and treated them favorably. But in the 13th century and following that, things began to change. The situation worsened drastically in the 1300s. The Black Death struck Spain, and of course, who's responsible for everything? The Jews. You know the story about the guy who was sitting in the park bench, the Jewish guy, and he's reading Farrakhan's newspaper? And a fellow comes over to him and says, "How can you read that rag sheet? Look what it says in there." He says, "When I read this, I see the Jews control this, the Jews are responsible for this, the Jews are responsible for this. We're responsible for everything. It's good news. It's good news." The Jews are responsible for everything. The Black Death was blamed on us. In June of 1391, riots broke out in Seville, and they rapidly spread through the country. And by the time the riots had died down, a full 2 months later, approximately 50,000 Jews had been killed, and numerous ancient Jewish communities had been destroyed. During the riots, the Jews were offered the choice, either die or convert. And we had a phenomena that had never occurred before in Jewish history. In mass, thousands of Jews chose to convert. They took conversion, even with the threat, rather than be killed. In 1411, a priest, Vincent Ferrara, later to become Saint Vincent, gives you some idea of the saints of the Catholic Church. There's a book, by the way, by the gentleman named Malcolm Hay, called Europe and the Jews. If you want to get a hold of that and read about all the saints, he traces the rise of Nazism directly from the New Testament and the whole history of it. Then you have all the quotes. You have Martin Luther and what he said about Jews. It's an eye-opener. In any case, St. Vincent embarked on a major mission to secure even more Jewish converts. Estimates put the number of Jews who converted during these two great waves, that is 1391 and 1412, as high as 400,000. It's unbelievable. There was a widespread feeling amongst the Jews that the conversion didn't really mean much. Once all the troubles passed, they would go back to being Jews. They were in for a surprise. Also, a shocking phenomena occurred in Spain. That is the conversion to Christianity of a number of prominent Torah scholars, of Talmidei Chachamim, Rabbonim, converted to Christianity. The most infamous of these was the Rabbi of Burgas, Solomon Halevi, who became Pablo de Santa Maria. He became a bishop in the Catholic Church. Not even warmed up. He persecuted Jews with exceptional zeal. This convert, this rabbi who had become a convert. He forced Jews to wear sackcloth, to sew a red badge on their sackcloth. He forbid Jewish men from trimming their beards, all sorts of things to make it difficult. After the pogroms were over and the anti-Jewish decrees began to be relaxed, the Jews thought that they'd be able to return to the practice of Judaism. But they were in for a surprise. The Pope sent out an edict in which he said that those who had been forcibly converted, we're talking about dragging you over to the fountain and pouring water on your head, and you're yelling and screaming, "No, no, no," those could go back and practice Judaism again. But all the others who had converted, because they were afraid of what might happen to them, or because they're afraid of, they were under pressure, but not actually at the moment, they could not return to Judaism. And indeed, to return to Judaism was punishable by death. It became impossible for these Jews then. Their lives were totally disrupted as Jews. They tried to keep as much as they could secretly, but for example, Bris Milah was impossible. Bris Milah was the kiss of death. You were finished if it was found out. Keeping certain other things, all of these things became impossible, and within about three generations, much of the Jewish community had forgotten whatever Judaism it knew. There were some stalwarts. In 1469, Ferdinand of Aragon, who himself was from... Let's back up and let's define a couple of terms. The term Marano was used to describe Jews who had converted to Christianity. Converso was also another term. And Anusim was used to describe those who had converted to Judaism. Ferdinand of Aragon had Jewish blood in him. He married Isabella of Castile, uniting the two most powerful Spanish regions under one royal family. Despite Ferdinand's power and his lineage, anti-Semitism increased. Indeed, they helped it. An Inquisition court was set up to ferret out and punish those who had converted to Christianity and had relapsed and were secretly practicing Judaism. The Inquisition publicized the signs of heretical behavior. What's heretical behavior? Changing the linen Erev Shabbos, buying vegetables before Pesach, not cooking on Shabbos, fasting on Yom Kippur, blessing one's children without making the sign of the cross. But there is something that most people do not realize. There were a group of people. There were a group of Jews who had never converted. They had remained steadfast in their commitment to Yiddishkeit. They were not subject to the Inquisition. I want to emphasize that. The Inquisition was for those Jews who had converted, or whose parents had converted, or whose grandparents had converted, and were supposed to be Christians. And they were relapsed. But if you had remained a Jew, the Inquisition didn't touch you. Now, you had a situation in Spain which was intolerable for the church, in the following sense. You had a group of people who were... It was questionable whether they were really Jews or not, whether they were really Christians. They had converted, or their parents, as I said, or their grandparents, but many of them were practicing secretly as much Judaism as you could. And then you had a group of authentic, we'll call them Jews, in the sense that they had never converted, and they were helping the conversos with their Yiddishkeit observance. They were helping with the observance of Judaism. And the Catholic Church found that intolerable. And they decided, one of the reasons they decided they wanted to get rid of the Jews. There were other reasons. They wanted the Jewish money. This was part of everything when it came to the Inquisition, by the way. Jewish money, etc. So, in March 31st, 1492, Ferdinand and Isabella issued an edict. They signed an edict, and all Jews had to leave the country in July of 1492. We know the day that they left was Tisha B'Av. Thousands left. These were the ones who had withstood it, who had withstood all the efforts, all the pressure to convert. They left. They went to a number of places, Morocco, Italy, the Ottoman Empire. But between 100,000 and 150,000 went to Portugal. And the king of Portugal welcomed them because he charged them a tax to come there and to live there, and he needed their money. He welcomed them. But he only allowed a very small percentage of them to settle permanently in Portugal. The others had temporary, quote-unquote, visas, and were required to leave within 8 months, and he promised that he would supply ships to take them. The bottom line is, at the end of 8 months, he didn't want to get rid of them. It's the old story. They can't stand the Jews, and they can't do without us. It's the old story. It's unbelievable. It's an unbelievable phenomenon. Jews were not allowed to leave. The next king of Portugal wanted to marry into the royal family of Spain. The royal family of Spain said, we will not allow one of our members to marry somebody from a country in which Jews live. You've got to get rid of all the Jews. So in 1497, you had the mass conversion of Portuguese Jewry. Physically, they were forced to convert. And then this king was able to send a message to the king and queen of Spain saying, there are no more Jews left in Portugal. Problem solved. Not really, though. 1492, there's another gentleman who comes to mind, Columbus, and his voyage. By the way, in my opinion, Columbus was not a Jew. There's a very interesting book by a Dr. Max Kaiserling called Christopher Columbus and the Participation of the Jews in the Spanish and Portuguese Discoveries. He talks about all the Jews and Muranos who were involved with Columbus in one way or another. He never mentions once anything about Columbus being a Jew. There's a huge amount of research. There are those who claim that Columbus is a Jew. I don't think he was. In any case, Columbus used Rabbi Abraham Zacuto's astronomical tables when he sailed. There were Jews who sailed with him, Muranos. His interpreter was Luis de Torres. He had an Alonso de Cali. He had a ship physician, Maestro Bernal, and a surgeon, Marco. By the way, none of these names sound Jewish. And there's a good reason why none of these names sound Jewish. Because these were all Muranos who had been baptized in the church, and they all had Christian names. Now, the Jews wanted to get out of Spain and Portugal. Those who were concerned to practice Judaism were constantly looking for a way out. In addition, the New World offered tremendous financial opportunity. So, Jews felt that if they could go to the New World, first of all, they would have the financial opportunities that they didn't have in Spain and Portugal. That's number one. Number two, they felt that the Inquisition would not follow them to the New World. Spain had, and Portugal, they were Mexico, or Mexico as my neighbor says, and Brazil, they had control of that. And Jews were amongst the earliest. But the Inquisition followed them to the New World, as we shall see. And in order to get some idea of what someone went through to maintain his Judaism, we're going to discuss a gentleman by the name of Luis de Carvajal, Jr. Carvajal. Again, my pronunciation is based on my neighbor who speaks Spanish. 1567 to 1596. Let's talk about this gentleman. He was born in Benevento, Portugal, and was baptized by the Bishop of Benevento. His early education consisting of studying reading, writing, and basic mathematics. Later, he attended a Jesuit school for 3 years where he was taught Latin and rhetoric. The fact that he knew Latin is going to turn out to be crucial in his story. His father was a Murano who influenced his wife and most of his 9 children to live as crypto-Jews, secret Jews. In 1584, Luis and his family immigrated to Mexico with his uncle. His uncle became an official, was given an official position in that country by the Spanish authorities, but his uncle was not a sympathizer for Judaism. In fact, they could not let the uncle know that they were secret Jews. Shortly after Luis got to Mexico, his father passed away. Luis went with his uncle. They explored the northern regions of the country, and wherever he went, he attempted to contact crypto-Jews, secret Jews, to learn as much as he could about Judaism. His drive to become an observant Jew is clearly evidenced in his description of how, after his father's passing, he circumcised himself in a ravine of the Panuco River. Quote from his writings, "When the Lord took my father away from this life, I returned to Panuco, where a clergyman sold me a sacred Bible for 6 pesos. It was in Latin, and remember, he could read Latin. That was the thing. He could read the language. I studied it constantly and learned much while alone in the wilderness. I came to know many of the divine mysteries. One day I read chapter 17 of Genesis, in which the Lord ordered Abraham our father to be circumcised, especially those words which say that the soul of him who will not be circumcised will be erased from among the book of the living. I became so frightened that I immediately proceeded to carry out the divine command. Prompted by the Almighty and His good angel, I left the corridor of the house where I had been reading, leaving behind the sacred Bible, took some old worn scissors, and went into the ravine of the Panuco River, there with longing and a vivid wish to be inscribed in the Book of the Living. Something that could not happen without the Holy Sacrament, I sealed it by cutting off almost all of the prepuce and leaving very little of it. It's unbelievable. Here's a man who has no Jewish education. He can't read a word of Hebrew. He doesn't. He may know a little bit of Shema, but what they said when you look in the papers, they didn't know how to say Shema the way, they didn't know how to make a bracha. Lewis and some of the members of the family became the focal point of a network of crypto-Jews living in Mexico City. He and some of his siblings encouraged former Jews to return to Judaism. Through their efforts, Jews were circumcised, studied Tanakh together, and observed the festivals. It was only a matter of time before his Judaizing would come to the attention of the Catholic officials. And indeed it did. A warrant was issued for his arrest on April 20th, 1589. He was found hiding in his mother's house on May 9th. He was questioned over several months and accused of being a secret Jew. What were the accusations? He was accused of having washed the body of his father before he buried it. He was accused of having studied the Old Testament, as they call it, and the prophets in order to be more knowledgeable in his practice of Judaism. He was accused of having quoted often from the Nevi'im. It was impossible to convince him that the prophets had predicted that Jesus Christ would come as Messiah. He had run away to Veracruz when his sister Isabel was imprisoned by the Holy Office, and finally that he had protected Judaizers by not denouncing them. He denied everything. It's not true. I didn't do it. Don't forget, the Inquisition was not a pleasant situation. Jews were tortured in order to get them to confess. They weren't told what they were accused of. They weren't told that. People accused them, and by the way, a lot of times they were accused for a reason that had nothing to do with Judaism. Here's a fellow who's a merchant, and there's a Jewish merchant also in the same business, and he doesn't like the competition, so how will he get rid of the Jewish merchant? He'll come to the Inquisitional Court, and he will say, he did such and such and such and such. And that's it. That's it. That's it. Finally, he was threatened with being tortured. Finally, in August 9, 1589, apparently seeing no way out of his predicament, he voluntarily appeared before the inquisitors. He went down on his knees. He kissed the floor. He shed tears, beat his breast, and said, "I have sinned. Mercy, mercy." Now, the whole goal of the Inquisition was to get the secret Jews to be reunited with the church, to give up their practice of Judaism. There were legal procedures, and on February 24, 1590, Lewis was permitted to be reconciled to the Catholic faith in an auto da fe. Auto da fe can mean burning, but it didn't mean burning the first time. It was a public confession. He was condemned to wear certain penitential cloak called the Sanbenito and to perpetual imprisonment. Now, there were no prisons. There was no prison in Mexico at that time in which to keep someone like Lewis. As a result, Lewis was transferred to a convalescent home in Mexico City where he was required to perform any services that the hospital administrator would require of him. He spent 2 years in the hospital doing all sorts of menial labor, completely isolated from his family. His mother and his four sisters had also been convicted in that auto da fe, and they had also confessed and begged for forgiveness, and they were confined to an isolated house near what was called the College of the Holy Cross in Mexico City. In 1592, one of their relatives petitioned the church, and for money you could get almost anything, to allow Lewis to be able to live with his mother and sister so that they would not be without some sort of a man on the premises to protect them if necessary. It was granted. He found his mother and sisters completely completely overcome by their experiences with the Inquisition, but it was not long before he persuaded them again to practice Jewish rituals. The house was near a certain College of the Holy Cross. The person who ran that was a Father Pedro de Oriz. He was the supervisor of the college. He took a liking to Lewis, and in fact he made Lewis his private secretary. He had Lewis teach Latin in the college, and he gave Lewis the keys to the library. Lewis, after all the students had left, spent hours at night reading all sorts of things in the library. He found Josephus's History of the Jews. It was an eye-opener for him. He found the sefer in which the Rambam's 13 principles were enunciated. It was unknown to people who lived in Spain and Portugal. Unknown. The net result was that Lewis became, as much as possible, a rather educated Jew. Their relatives, the relatives of the Carvajals, had been petitioning the authorities. And finally, for the payment of a fine, they were released. And all the penalties that were imposed on them in 1590 were taken away. So that's in 1594, they're free. They remained free for exactly 3 months. And then the Inquisition came after him again, because he wouldn't stop. He wouldn't stop, ladies and gentlemen. There was no way he was going to stop. He was committed to Yiddishkeit. Unbelievable. He was arrested, another trial. Many witnesses testified against him. There was a lot of stuff to say about him, and it was true. He realized that as a relapsed apostate, second time around, you lose. You get burned at the stake. It's death. Now, there are a couple of ways to be burned at the stake. Let's explain this. Burning is obviously a horrible death. However, if somebody who's a two-time loser confesses his sins, then they are what's called garroted. That is, strangled with a wire. A wire is put around the neck and around a pole and twisted, and they're put to death that way, and then they're burnt. That's better than burning, they tell me. That's better than burning. That's a fact. In any case, he knew that it was all over. He knew that they had the goods on him, so he did not hold back anything. This time he admitted that he was a Jew. He was tortured for nearly 2 years, and finally, on December 1596, he was burned at the stake in Mexico City. By the way, when they asked him, "Are you ready to renounce this Judaism?" he said, "No." He responded, "I wish to live as a Jew and die observing the law of Moshe." He could talk with them. He could argue with them. He knew now what he was talking about. He had 9 reasons for not believing in Christianity. That must have made them very happy. Must have made them very happy. In any case, he was burned at the stake in Mexico City with his mother and 3 of his sisters. This was on December 8, 1596. It was the first time that a Jewish woman had been burnt at the stake in Mexico. One priest claims that before he was burnt to death, he kissed the cross and he said, yeah, he begged forgiveness and he was garroted. But it's not clear at all that that's really what happened. He was survived by a saintly sister, Anika, a beloved disciple, Justa Mendez, his brothers, 2 brothers who had escaped to Europe. That was the end of Lewis Carvajal Jr., an amazing character. I got an invitation recently, an email from somebody, I think it was in Texas, inviting me to a conference about the Carvajals. Unfortunately, it was on Pesach, so I said I can't come, but it was interesting. In any case, this is just one example. There were others. There were people who left Spain and Portugal in the hope that the Inquisition would leave them alone, in the hope that they would be able to practice Judaism as much as they could. And they were hunted down like dogs. And eventually there were more in, we're talking about now the 16th century, there were also in the 17th century, until eventually in Mexico anyway, all vestiges of Judaism virtually were wiped out. Now let's turn to Recife, Brazil. 1630 to 1654. Now, Brazil was originally under Portuguese control. Portugal, Inquisition. But in 1630, the Dutch captured a large section of Brazil. The Dutch had a very liberal attitude towards Judaism. Many of those who could escape from Portugal and from Spain to Amsterdam. Amsterdam had a flourishing Jewish community. Now, this may shock some of you, but there was no pizza store in Amsterdam, although it was a flourishing Jewish community. In fact, the whole community may have been 2,000 Jews, if that. But there was a flourishing Jewish community. There were synagogues there. There were rabbonim there. It was a Shalachim came there, I'm sure, absolutely. In any case, in 16, Jews had come to Brazil earlier, shortly after 1500. They were secret Jews, they were Moranos. They were involved in the sugar trade, they were involved in other things, but everything was kept secret and hush-hush. In 1630, when the Dutch conquered this region of Brazil, Recife was a main city, it's on the water. It's apparently a very nice resort. I've never been there, but it's a beautiful resort. And all of a sudden, a phenomenon began to occur. Jews began to sneak out of the woodwork. These Jews began to openly practice Judaism. Others joined them. In fact, in 1642, no less than 600 Jews from Amsterdam embarked for Recife. Now, this is the only instance in the New World, and by the way, who came? Who came in amongst that 600? Rabbi Isaac Abov de Fonseca and Rabbi Moshe Rafo de Aguilar. These are Talmidei Chachamim. They brought with them religious officials. They brought a Jewish community. Recife became a suburb, in a certain sense, of Amsterdam. Nothing like that ever happened since then in America. One of the problems in American Jewry is the fact that there were no religious officials. There was no community structure. There was nothing. They came to Recife and they built a Jewish community. There were two synagogues at least. Less than 10 years ago, they excavated in Recife. There was something called the Jew Street. It was known that was the name. And they found the location of the shul. How did they find the location of the shul? Because they found the bore for the mikveh. And it was outside the wall. It was inside the walls of the building. You don't build a well inside a building. It was a mikveh. So they know that that's where it was. It was a vibrant Jewish community. There was a tzedakah fund. There was an elementary level Talmud Torah and an upper level yeshiva in which Gemara was taught. Each adult male was required to stand guard on a regular basis. There are documents that show that Jews were exempt from doing guard duty on Shabbos. They were essentially all observant. This is an important fact. This is a vibrant Jewish community. A vibrant Jewish community. What did they have to do? They didn't stand guard on Shabbos, so they had to pay to hire Gentiles to stand guard for them. During the 24 years that Recife was under Dutch rule, the Jews developed a vibrant Jewish community. Recife became the first place in the New World where Judaism was practiced openly. Its members were doctors, lawyers, peddlers, and merchants. Many Jews prospered in the tobacco, precious gems, wood, and sugar trades. It even had a street called the Street of the Jews, in which the synagogue was located. Everything changed in 1654. Because that's when the Portuguese were constantly trying to recapture the land that they had lost. And indeed, in 1654, Portugal reconquered Brazil. The Jews knew they had to leave. Because Portugal means Inquisition. You can't stay. So they all left. at least all those had been openly Jews. They left. A total of 16 ships transported both Jewish and Dutch colonists from Recife. 15 arrived safely. However, the 16th was captured by Spanish pirates, only to be overtaken by the St. Charles, a French privateer. After much negotiating, the master of the St. Charles agreed to bring a group of 23 Jewish men, women, and children from the captured ship to New Amsterdam for 900 guilders in advance and 1,600 on arrival. These 23 refugees arrived in New Amsterdam in 1654. They, together with at least two other Jews — there were other Jews here before they came to New York, there were some others — they became the founders of the Jewish community. Now, the 23 Jews arrived on September 7, 1654. They were not welcomed. You probably know Peter Stuyvesant didn't love the Jews. In fact, he hated them. He wanted to get rid of them. And he did his best to get rid of them. He felt that they were a burden on the community. He said none of the Gentiles wanted to have anything to do with them. They didn't believe in Jesus Christ. They were defamers. They were blasphemers. Boom, 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 boom. So he wrote to the... Now, New Amsterdam was a colony that was owned by a trading company in Amsterdam. And he wrote to the leaders, to the owners of that trading company, and told them that you got to get them out, got to get rid of them. He wants to kick them out. He wants permission to kick them out. What he didn't count on was the following. He didn't count on the fact that there were a number of wealthy Jews who were shareholders in this company in Amsterdam. And that was the reason why the Jews were not forced to leave. Because those shareholders, those stockholders, used their influence to make it clear that the Jews were to stay in New York. It was New Amsterdam then. They also pointed out that the Jews had lost a huge amount of resources in Brazil, and therefore the Jews were allowed to stay. Stuyvesant was not happy. Even when they were allowed to stay, he did his best to make trouble for them, as we'll see. Now, we know the names of some of these people. We know the names of some of these people. There's Abraham and David Israel, Moses, Ambrosius or Lombroso, Asser Levy. You know there's something called Asser Levy Place in Manhattan? It's one of our heroes. It's a Shomer Shabbos Shochet. Really? He had it written in his contract that he didn't have to slaughter pigs. When you look at, we have what he left over, his property. He apparently was childless. When you look at the things that his household utensils that were left over, there's a listing of them that has come down to us. There's two of this and two of this and two of this. One milchiks, one fleishiks. There's no question. No question. There's a Sabbath lamp for Shabbos. Asher Levy was a Shomer Shabbos. By the way, they were all, virtually all of them were. A couple we'll talk about this one. Anyway, when the Jews came here, these 23 souls, there were two others at least who had preceded them. One of them is Solomon Peterson, and the other is Jacob Bar Simpson. Now, Jacob Bar Simpson, why didn't Stuyvesant try to get rid of Jacob Bar Simpson? He didn't. Because Jacob Bar Simpson came with a passport. He had legal right to be here. It had been granted to him. Whereas the Jews, the 23 that came, did not have papers. They did not have papers. Now, what did they do very shortly? They came on September 7th, right? 1654? I'm sure you all know that September 12th was Rosh Hashanah, came out on Shabbos and Sunday. There were enough of them to make a minyan. Because between the Bar Mitzvah boys and between Peterson and Bar Simpson and the other men that came with them, they made a minyan for Rosh Hashanah. They made a minyan. I don't think they had a shofar, I don't think they had a sefer Torah, but they started. Solomon Peterson, though, has a distinction, quote-unquote, which is not so nice, unfortunately. The most difficult challenge facing New Amsterdam's nascent Jewish community, one that American Jews would confront time and again through the centuries, was how to persevere and to pursue, to preserve and maintain Judaism, particularly with their numbers being so small. There were less than 100 Jews in New York in the beginning. Indeed, it wasn't until 1750 that there were 300 Jews. It's nothing. And Jews faced something which they did not face in Europe. They faced an open society. They faced a society in which basically, although of course Stuyvesant was an anti-Semite, but the average Gentile said, "You're welcome here. Hello, how are you?" They weren't locked into a ghetto. And this is a tremendous challenge, to face an open society. So they faced this open society. At one extreme stood Solomon Peterson, a merchant from Amsterdam who came to town in 1654, just prior to the refugees from Recife, to seek his fortune. In 1656, he became the first known Jew on American soil to marry a Christian. Not a big skus. While it is not clear that he personally converted, the daughter that resulted from the marriage, named Anna, was baptized in childhood. However, you have a different story on the other side. First of all, let me make something clear. The Jews who came here in 1654 were not Muranos in general. They were both Ashkenaz and Sephardi Jews. That's what they were. It's later that the Muranos began to come. According to Hyman B. Grinstein's The Rise of the Jewish Community of New York, a fascinating book, in 1695 there were 20 Jewish families in New York. Assuming each family had an average of 5 members, this means there were about 100 Jews in New York. The number did not grow very quickly because there were only 300 Jews in 1750. By the 1690s, the 20 Jewish families had an official synagogue. By 1706, they had an official constitution and called themselves Congregation Sherith Israel. And in 1729, they built their synagogue building on Mill Street, which they continued to use for a century. By the way, it's interesting that all of the synagogues founded in the New World, all of them, in Savannah, in Virginia, in Philadelphia, wherever they were, they all followed the Nusach Sfard, but not the Nusach Sfard that some people daven here in Brooklyn, but the Nusach Portuguese Sfard, the real Nusach Sfard. And in fact, there was no Ashkenaz shul until about 1820-something in New York. Even though the majority of Jews in America were Ashkenazic after a certain point, because that's who came. And by the way, many of them came. They came from Bavaria, from Germany. They were German Jews. Still, the Nusach was this far. And that was in all of the synagogues. Asa Levi was a pioneer in fighting for the rights of Jews in New Amsterdam. He wasn't a slouch. He wasn't afraid to rock the boat. He wasn't afraid to make noise. And he learned very quickly how to use the legal system to his advantage. But let's back up one moment. We mentioned Bar Simpson. Bar Simpson was a defendant. He was called to court in 1658. A charge was brought against Jacob Bar Simpson. The court record stated, though defendant is absent, he didn't show up, yet no default is entered against him as he was summoned on his Sabbath. He wouldn't go to court on Shabbos. He was from Jew, an observant Jew. That's what he was, Jacob Bar Simpson. Asa Levi was constantly agitating for Jewish rights. In 1655, he protested when Stuyvesant and local officials required male Jews between 16 and 60 to pay a tax in lieu of guard duty. In those days, every able-bodied man had to serve a certain amount of time on guard duty to guard the settlement. Stuyvesant had cited the disinclination and unwillingness of local residents to serve as fellow soldiers with the Jewish nation and to be on guard with them in the same guardhouse. Levy insisted, however, that as a manual laborer, he should be able to stand guard just like everyone else. By the way, what did Stuyvesant want them to do? They couldn't stand guard, but they had to pay money to hire people who would stand guard for them. We won't let you do it, but we'll make you pay for it. That was what was going on. Although initially thwarted within 2 years, he had succeeded in standing watch and ward like other burghers. Whereupon, he promptly petitioned for burgher rights. That means citizenship. Again, he was thwarted, but backed by wealthy Jewish merchants who had immigrated months before from Amsterdam and recalled the promises made to them by the quote-unquote worshipful lords of the Dutch West India Company, the decision was reversed and the rights of Jews to burghership were guaranteed. As a result of these legal actions, Arthur Levy and Jacob Bar Simpson kept watch and guard with the other non-Jewish male residents of New Amsterdam. In addition, in 1657, all male Jews who lived in the town gained the rights of burghership, of citizenship. Besides being a butcher, Levy was a trader and a landowner. He was a jack of all trades. Arthur Levy was just the man for his environment. He was neither refined nor cultured, and certainly he was insensitive to rebuffs because they kept bashing at him, trying to deny him things, and he would not give in. His energy was boundless. His obstinacy tremendous. He was blunt, thick-skinned, pugnacious, generous, fearless, pushing, jealous of his honor and that of his co-religionists, and successful. He was a successful man. Among the Jews who immigrated to New Amsterdam in 1654, he was the only one who stayed, maintaining a home in the city until his death in 1682. This is from Jonathan Sarna. Sarna claims that the only Jew who remained in New York during a certain period was Arthur Levy. Most people do not agree with that. For long, lonely stretches, as Dutch rule waned and the rest of the Jews departed for colonies where more sun and promise, with more sun and promise, he was the only Jewish family in town. Yet the inventory of his estate suggests that he resolutely observed at least the principal rituals of his faith, including Shabbos and Kashrus, within the precincts of his home. His life epitomized both the hardships entailed in being a Jew in early colonial America and the possibilities of surmounting them. He's a success story. I think we will stop here. There's much, much more to be said, but how long can you sit and listen, particularly after a day's work or whatever? I will, if you have questions, be willing to answer, or try, I should say, to answer some of the questions. But let me explain how I'm going to do it. This is a little digital device which will allow me to take this talk and put it onto my computer. And then it becomes a Windows Media audio file. Then I can convert it into an MP3 file, and I throw it up on my website, and anybody who wants to listen to it can. However, based on previous experience, people have told me that it would be good if I repeated the questions once they're asked. So I will do that and hopefully not annoy you. So I don't know if there are questions. Herb?
Before you go through a Q&A, just on behalf of the shul and all assembled, I want to thank you for adding to our pleasure. And hopefully that everyone will show up for the next lecture so the crowd will not be divided at all. And the next lecture is Friday, February the 22nd. It's a week from Friday, 8 o'clock right here. And we'll discuss the colonial Jewish communities. I'm sure Rabbi Dr. Professor Levy.
No Rabbi. Rabbi is not a profession for a Jewish boy. I told that to Rabbi Yosef Frankel, and he agreed with me.
I'm sure Rabbi Dr. Professor Levy will amplify it further. You see, Jews are pugnacious and stubborn. I'm related to Osler Levy.
I think it, yes.
Anyway, any questions or answers? There was a, excuse me just for a second, there was a request for a minion, for Marv Minion.
Ashkenaz.
Ashkenaz. So I would say 9:15 we'll have a minion here for Marv.
Fine, yes.
Thank you again. Thank you very much.
Ma'am.
You said there were 16 ships that left for Sifi. What happened to the 15?
All right. The question is, there were 16 ships that left for Sifi, and what happened to the other 15? They went to a variety of places, and I really meant to mention it, but I didn't. There were Jewish colonies throughout the Caribbean, Jewish communities throughout the Caribbean. St. Eustatius and Guadeloupe and Martinique and Barbados and Jamaica and Curacao and all these places. Some of them went there. A number of them, most of them went back to Amsterdam, but interestingly enough, most of those people ended up returning to the New World later. Yes. Sir.
As far as those Jews who founded the synagogues in different cities in America, are there any direct descendants of them still around today that we know whether they were steadfast in their observance of Judaism?
The question, if I may paraphrase it, is, are there observant descendants of those who remain true to Judaism? It's a fascinating question. It's an interesting question. First of all, I quoted from Rabbi Avraham Rice, who was totally, he's later, of course, came here in 1840, but he was totally disillusioned with America. His children were not observant, his grandchildren were not observant, but there was a gentleman that lived in Baltimore whom I myself knew, Phil Rice, Shraga Rice. Shraga Rice became first a Lubavitcher Chassid, and then he became a Satmar Chassid. Rabbi Rice has great-great-grandchildren with Langa Peyas in Yerushalayim. So you never know. Now, the Frank family, which is a famous colonial family, they were all assimilated, unfortunately. There's a gentleman I'm going to talk about next time, Yisrael Ber Kershid, an unusual fellow. He was the first person to come and live in America who was a real Talmud Chacham. He had learned in the yeshiva of Nosson Adler. Now, Kershid's children, all of his children married Jews. That was an accomplishment in those days. That was an accomplishment. But sadly enough, so many of them went by the by. It's not just them, by the way. I don't know if you read the Jewish press. I'll put in a plug because they publish my stuff without questioning me and giving me a hard time. There are other publications that do give me a hard time about certain things that I write, but we will not mention them here. The Inquisition still exists. The PC Haredi police are alive and well. And they are really functioning, but in any case, I wrote an article about a gentleman by the name of Henry P. Schneeberger, who was the first ordained, American-born, ordained university degree rabbi in America. Nothing left of his children. Shepsel Schaffer, whose father-in-law was Alexander Moshe Lapidus, that's a chaver of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta. That ain't small stuff, ladies and gentlemen. And his children, nothing.
Justice to these fathers, those who came in the second immigration, let's say, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, there's a big resurgence of Judaism.
Yes, today. But the key problem in America was no chinuch. And by the way, let's understand, what is responsible for the vibrant Jewish community that we see today in America? In my opinion, it is the yeshivas. It is the fact that people made yeshivas, they put their kids in yeshiva. There were no religious officials, there were no teachers, there was no nothing, there was no Jewish education. And then once public school became common and free, by the way, you were anti-American at one point if you didn't send your children to public school. There were very frum families whose children all went to public school. It was unheard of. But I have stories, but I'm not going to tell them now. Yes.
What is your source that Asher Levy was one of the 23? The story, most historians don't believe he's part of the 23.
Who told you that? I wrote an article. It's in the Jewish press. All right. Let me explain. Where is most of my stuff coming from? The American Jewish Historical Society, which is located in Manhattan. Where is it on
15.
Thank you. 15. Okay. There. They have a journal of the American Jewish Historical Society, and one can access that online. From its beginning till 1978. In 78, Johns Hopkins took it over, and now you have to pay money to look at it. But anyway, I can access it and I can search it. And there's an article by, I have it, Wisnitzer or something, but I wrote an article about this. He has it there. He has it there. That's right. And as I explained to you, the Jews who came to New York were not all Sephardim.
Was he in Brazil?
I don't know, because that ship stopped somewhere in the Caribbean. He may have gotten on there. But I have an article about this. The Jews come to New York, the Jewish press, it's on the website, it's all there. Sir?
I believe Grinstein also maintained that Asher Levy came along.
Well, Grinstein, I never met him, but I have a friend who has a PhD in American Jewish history. He holds him as a godel.
I study him.
Okay, so he's somebody special. Yeah, yeah. Sir?
So, just a point of, you mentioned you had a website.
Yes.
And you mentioned the book earlier,
Okay, yeah, I mentioned, all right, first of all, the book I can give you easily. The book is by Malcolm Hay, H-A-Y. Hay is a Gentile, was a Gentile. And it's called The Jews in Europe, I think. Something like that, by Malcolm Hay. And Hay traces anti-Semitism. He tells you about Saint Bernard, who wasn't such a saint when it came to Jews. He has the quotes. Martin Luther said that you should lock the Jews in their synagogue and set fire to them. The Nazis had what to learn from. They had plenty of what to learn from. It's all there. It's all there. The website. Okay. I'll give it to you, but the easiest thing is to search. But it's the following. /personal.stevens.edu/tilde, that's the squiggly sign, LLEVINE, and then if you want the publication, /pub.html. But if you search Dr. Yitzchak Levine, or I have a secular name, Larry Levine or L.E. Levine, it should come up. The website, you go to Stevens' website, stevens.edu, and you search for me, and that stuff should come up. Other questions, sir?
Yeah, I don't know whether this was true or not, but I saw this on something on the website that said that Eleanor Roosevelt's mother was a Sephardic Jew, and it also said that the Roosevelts came on the boat as Sephardic Jews to America in the 1600s.
I don't know anything about this. Somebody sent me an article that Lincoln was a Jew, this one was a Jew, that one was a Jew. I really don't know. I really don't know. One of the things I try to do, and I do write a monthly column in the Jewish press called Glimpses into American Jewish History. It appears the first week of the month, and those articles have footnotes, although the editor doesn't like footnotes, and he fights with me, but I put in footnotes because I believe people should know where it's coming from. So there's that, and that all those are linked on my website, and then every once in a while I write a front page article for the Jewish press. coming out, I believe, at the end of February. I say I believe because my stuff is not time sensitive, so if the editor of the Jewish Press has something that's time sensitive, he'll bump my article and push it. But I have an article about Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. His life was a disaster and a tragedy here. And then there's two follow-up monthly columns. And his funeral, whether you know it or not, was one of the most anti-Semitic incidents in American Jewish history. But that's for the last talk, I think. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am.
Have you come across any mention as to where the first burial ground was, the one before Chatham Square?
Nobody knows where the first burial ground was. They don't know. They don't know. They don't know. Yes, ma'am.
You had mentioned that at one point during the Spanish Inquisition that the Jews did not have to convert? When was that?
Okay. No. Wait. Let me be clear. I mentioned about Jews not converting. There was pressure on the Jews to convert. And in certain periods, if you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, they threatened to kill you unless you converted. But there were Jews who were not, who didn't happen to be there, who hid, etc. And those Jews, although there was economic pressure, and there was also propaganda to get the Jews to convert, there were Jews who resisted. And the point, there were a considerable number. There were several hundred thousand, maybe 300,000 that left Spain, and those Jews were Jews who had not converted. See, those who had converted couldn't leave Spain. That's again, I want to make this point because a lot of people don't quite know this. Those who had converted, even if it was forced, were considered Christians by the church, and you couldn't get out, and that was it. Those who had never converted were not touched by the Inquisition, but they were driven out because they were considered a bad influence on the new converts.
If they refused, the church didn't put them to death? They were able to.
If you happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, then you were killed.
Uh-huh.
But if you were hiding,
I see. Okay.
And you were never under that threat, then you didn't have to convert. And there were somewhere between, we don't know exactly, maybe 300,000, 400,000. They say 100,000, 150,000 came to Portugal. Those were Jews who had never converted. Anyone else? Sir?
Didn't a lot of the Jews also go to Holland from the Inquisition?
When you say a lot, you see...
It's popular. I mean, when the Jewish history talks about most of the Jews going to Holland...
Wait. Let's understand. First of all, the question is, didn't most of the Jews go to Holland? First of all, we have to understand what numbers mean, what numbers meant then as opposed to today. There are, I'm sure, more Jews in Flatbush today than there were in entire Amsterdam at its height. It's a fact, okay? A Jewish community of 1,000, 1,200, 2,000 was a big Jewish community. It's a big Jewish community. Many Jews lived in little towns, 10, 12 families, many of them. Now, Jews did try to go from Portugal in particular to Amsterdam. But they didn't go in mass. It was only later. The Dutch community, the Jewish community in Amsterdam is in the early 1630, something like 1620, okay? They were driven out in 1492. Okay. A lot of them went to Turkey, to the Ottoman Empire. A lot of them went there. Some went to Morocco. They went to all sorts of places. Okay, but Amsterdam became a safe haven for those later who could get out of Portugal or Spain and get to Amsterdam. And there are many stories of Jews who escaped. And when they got there, the procedure was the following. And we're talking 100 and 200 years, and we'll talk about some of them in one of the other lectures. The procedure was the following. The men had themselves circumcised. They married, they took Jewish names. The wives took Jewish names. They married their wives kehalacha, and they did their best to resume Jewish observance or to learn about Judaism. And some of them made tremendous strides. One last question, and then, yes, sir.
You mentioned that one of the main causes for the lack of a vibrant Jewish community was the lack of chinuch. But it isn't to the fact that most of these situations are the result of an insufficient quantity of practicing Jews that can be there to get together. When you talk about 100 to start with and 300 after another 50 years, you're talking about a minute quantity, many of whom were out west or midwest or wherever, not New York. So it couldn't be expected to be able to begin to have a political kind of combination.
The question is, isn't it more numbers than chinuch? I have to disagree with you. In my opinion, I believe that chinuch is the central pivot on which all of Yiddishkeit rests. Torah, learning, educating Jews. That's what it's all about. There was a series on television called The American Jewish Experience or something. A disaster, in my opinion. I sent them an angry email saying, you totally ignored all of Orthodoxy. And I sent them a list after the first one. You didn't talk about Asa Levi, you didn't talk about this one, you didn't talk about that one. You didn't talk about boom, 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 boom. You see how thousands of Jews who had no real Torah education gave up their Yiddishkeit. The Lower East Side was a disaster. And there were thousands of Jews there. There is no substitute for yeshiva education. And this, by the way, was a chiddush in America. The first school, the first yeshiva, is Yeshiva Eitz Chaim. It was an intermediary school. Started with boys 10, 11. It's, I think, 1897. But the first yeshiva on which all of our schools are modeled was RJJ. Rabbi Yaakov Yosef School started in 1902. It was the first school. It was an elementary school. It was the first school to have a total Torah program and give a total secular education. By the way, secular education ran from Sunday to Thursday. They went Sunday afternoon also. And that's the model. RJJ started in 1902. In 1913, there were already 600 boys there. But that's a drop in the bucket compared to the Jews that were here in the Lower East Side and all over. And all these communities in the Midwest, there was no Torah education. I'm going to stop in 1 second. I'm going to mention the Raskis family of St. Louis. Raskis family came here in the late 19th century. In 1900, they did something unbelievable. They sent two sons to Slabodka to learn. One was 12. To Slabodka. Now, they didn't call home on their cell phones two and three times a day. Okay? And they didn't see mommy and daddy and fly home for Pesach. Or for the summer. Or for this or that. Meant really sending your children away. What was the net result? Today the Raskises have observant grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. And it's because those two boys went to Slabodka and then they sent their sons. And by the way, girls...
I went to yeshiva.
What?
I went to yeshiva.
Okay. I wrote an article about the Raskis family. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you.
Again, thank you very, very much.